Okay, meeting will come to order. This is Government Operations and Veterans Affairs. Today on March 17th, St. Patrick's Day. See several members dressed for the occasion. We do have a quorum. We'll do the approval of minutes. Representative Seibert.
Madam Chair, I'd move that we approve the minutes, and I think I might even frame them.
Okay. Representative Seibert moves approval of the minutes of the March 16th meeting. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Seibert. Okay, members, we have three bills up today, and as we've been mentioning the last several meetings, we'll be adding extra evening meetings in over the next couple weeks. We will be meeting Monday evening and probably Tuesday evening, too, generally starting at about 6 o'clock. We'll have to see how things go on the House floor Monday evening. I would like to allow at least a half hour dinner break before we start the meeting, and we'll kind of go till we're done. Last night we were in environment policy till, 11:30, hopefully not that late. So generally we try to get out about 10 or so. And then, so next week we have those two evening meetings and then also our two regularly scheduled times on Tuesday and Wednesday. And then we have the Easter break and we'll come back and have additional meetings there as well. And I just wanted to make note to the members, if there are any bills that members of this committee have that haven't been heard yet, please get in touch with me and Committee Administrator Scott Neske. We want to have hearing request forms completed. And we're going to kind of prioritize bills based on if there's action in the Senate on the bill. In other words, if you don't have a Senate companion, probably not too likely it's going to get heard this close to deadline. Remember, we do have next year, and all the bills will remain active for next year. If you've got a Senate companion that's active, we need to kind of start looking at if the House bill is going to meet first deadline or second deadline, depending on where you are in the Senate. So I do want to make sure we hear as many member bills as possible. Okay, in your packet, there's an overview sheet from Mr. Shepherd about the three bills today. We're going to try to keep to the elements of the bills that relate to governmental operations. The first bill up, 1081 here, looks like some things on page 5. I'd like the chair to officially move House File 1081, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Environment and Ag Finance. Is that correct, Representative Osment? Okay. And I understand that you have an author's amendment, the A050303 amendment, and Chair will move that amendment. Representative Osment, can you tell us about the amendment? We'll get that on the bill, and then you can tell us about the bill. Representative Osment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This bill is really our miscellaneous issues bill, very often called a technical bill. I don't like to use that term because sometimes things get a little bit shaky if they think it's strictly technical. So just to know, it's miscellaneous issues. This is one of those issues that we'd like to add to it, and I'd like to have Mr. Weirds Myers talk to this or speak about this particular
amendment. Okay, to the 303 amendment.
Mr. Myers. Madam Chair, members, the amendment in front of you today.
Oh, excuse me, you need to identify yourself for the record.
Tom Meyer, Legislative Affairs Director of the Department of Natural Resources.
Thank you.
The A050303 amendment is a technical correction to the language that was passed last year. The language you see on page 2 was to assure that we have no complications with state or federal flood insurance programs. We've worked this language out with all the interested parties, League of Minnesota Cities, and other business interests that didn't work on this issue last session. It's a bill that is introduced in the House and Senate because of lack of action and deadlines. We'd like to amend it onto this bill here. I can stand for any questions. Dealing with floodplain and where the nonconformities and regulations shall take place.
Okay, see no questions. Let's get the A303 on, and that'll get the bill in the shape that the author prefers. All in favor of the 303 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and amendment is adopted. Representative Osment, your bill is before us as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And do you want me to go through the bill or just page 5?
Well, if you could give us a quick overview, but we'd like to try to keep our committee's issues to the page 5 things that relate to our committee, but certainly we need to know about the bill in general. Representative Othman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as I mentioned, members, this is a DNR bill with a few miscellaneous issues, and like Mr. Myers to walk through that briefly for.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, Bob Meyer again, DNR. Section 1 of the bill deals with chains that we need to put in place for commercial fishing and invasive species, and when you can take nets out of infested waters and put them in other waters. We're clarifying some language that we did pass last year, an oversight that we had that did take place. Section 2 actually creates the water recreation account. This is an account that we've had in statute for a long time. There's money that has been appropriated and deposited into the account, but we've just come to realize that there is no formal statutory creation of the account. So we're trying to correct that with this language here. Whether the receipts and purposes of the account are for. On page 3, subdivision 3, beginning on line 13, you'll see that we're clearly identifying the purposes of this account, and these purposes do reflect the historical expenditures from the account, and just put some sketches what the actions are today. You'll see it deals with rehabilitation of public water access and boarding facilities, and also aquatic invasive species management and aquatic plant management programs. Section 3 of the bill is the reason why the bill is in front of you today. We're simply trying to extend the sunset provision for the Department of Natural Resources Game and Fish Budget Oversight Committee. We'd like to do that from 2005 to 2010. The statutory oversight tasks are as follows. They review annual reports of game and fish fund revenue and expenditures and make recommendations to the commission and the legislature. They also recommend outcome goals for game and fish fund expenditures and make recommendations for the biennial budget, even number years. Their work has accumulated in a report that I have right here that is presented to the legislature that really outlines the recommendations and our oversight. It's a very important committee to us, that it does help us provide one of our main goals of the department, fund integrity. The purposes that money is raised, that they're being used for those exact purposes. They oversee our stamp accounts. There are 9 subcommittees appointed by the DNR commissioner using the appointment process. Trout and salmon stamp subcommittee, the fisheries operations subcommittee, waterfowl stamp subcommittee, pheasant stamp subcommittee, turkey stamp subcommittee, big game subcommittee for deer and bear, wildlife operations subcommittee, ecological services subcommittee, and enforcement support services and administration. So we're trying to extend their sunset provision. We would not want to lose this group as they provide us and also the legislature with vital information and feedback on our funding of these programs. Section 4 of the bill clarifies the contents of an annual report dealing with lifetime licenses. This reflects current practice as well. Currently, law states that we need to describe projects, funded locations of the projects, and results and benefits of the projects that are funded with the lifetime license receipts. When you buy a lifetime license, they go into a dedicated fund, and when you activate that license on a yearly basis, those funds are then transferred into the game and fish account. Game and fish fund, I should say. So when you take your card, you go to the ELS agent, and you get your yearly license, we transfer that amount from your fishing license into the game and fish fund. Because these funds are then commingled with the other license receipts that we receive, it's difficult for us to describe the specific projects that are funded with these funds and the locations of the projects and results and benefits. We've been reporting this information in a commingled fashion about all of the projects that the Game and Fish Fund are funding and the outcomes that they have. So we're trying to, once again, reflect statute with current practices. Section 5 on line 28, we're depositing the money from aquatic plant management fees from the game and fish account where they currently go into the water recreation account. So we don't, currently we're taking funds for these activities from 2 different accounts. We want to simplify that, make it easier for us to track and more transparent for people to track in the legislature and other places. So we want those funds deposited and mixed, collected with the same funds from the water rec account. Section 6 of the bill repeals some what we believe is antiquated language requiring us to approve expenditures, county expenditures from timber receipts. Currently, we're rarely, if ever, asked to do this, and this again reflects current practice. Section 7 of the bill is similar to that. In Section 8 of the bill, you'll see on page 8, line 35, we're striking the word state park development from the purposes of the water rec account. The intention of this language when it was placed in the statute was to allow us for boat dock and boat access, water access sites in state parks. We want to make sure that those are eligible expenditures under the current practice and under the way that we've clarified the purposes of the account. We just feel that state park development is a little too broad of a term for water rec expenditures. That is the bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Okay. Questions to the bill as amended, and members, basically, we're looking at page 5, line 27, and it relates to the expiration date of the subcommittees that are mentioned on page 4 and 5. Questions on the bill? Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got two brief questions. Why is there a need for oversight? Let's say the manager of whatever division isn't that person accountable? Or isn't the commissioner accountable? Why do we need somebody to have an oversight of what's going on in regard to miscellaneous activities under the DNR?
Representative Hosmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Dempsey. This is identifying the oversight from the citizens group, and this is to assure that as the DNR is going forward with their different activities, especially licensed activities that involve our sporting opportunities in the state of Minnesota, that they have continual interaction between the citizens that they're impacting on, especially when you're setting things up. I know it's like we have the round table for the fishing, so whenever you're going to change limits or change the dates on when things are open, they have a public exposure of those issues and get feedback before the DNR actually goes forward and does these things. So this is where we actually establish that interaction.
Paul Upcrop, send us.
And then why only a 5-year extension, Representative, if... I'll just ask that question. Why only a 5-year extension? Is that just precedence or what?
Madam Chair, Representative Dempsey, I don't have a good answer for that. I know that the Governmental Operations Committee has had different policies over the years with regard to sunsets. I know that many times they have put sunsets in place a few years ago, and almost everything got one, whether it was needed it or not. And then I think now as they're coming back for review, it'll be up to the committee to decide. Is 5 years enough, 10 years enough? It's whatever really, it's only there to try and assure that the this program remains accountable to the legislature, and it's however often you think it should come back to the legislature. That's the only reason. 5 years, I think, is what the administration put in here, and it's, but there isn't any specific reason other than needed a number.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, next up, Representative Hahn.
I guess this is a question about these committees. Are they paid expenses, and how does that work?
Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, Representative Hahn, they operate similar to any other advisory committee that's out there under current statute, receiving mileage, basically, and we give them lunch or dinner, actually, because this group is unique in any other advisory committee I've worked with in state government, is that they meet at night. They'll come down, and often they drive considerable distances. The chair is actually from Grand Rapids, so he comes down oftentimes on his personal time to work with staff and talk and do research, but the only per diem that they receive is a mileage per diem and a modest sandwich and a bag of chips.
Okay.
A bottle of water.
Give them an apple, maybe?
They get an apple.
All that and a bag of chips.
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Hahn.
Yes. Well, Madam Chairman and Representative, at first as I was looking at this, one of the things I've been working with in the water, and I guess those committees are only game and fish. They're not for the Water Recreation Fund. One of the things I've been working on, the issue of the Whitewater Canoe and Kayak Park, and so I was just checking. Is there any advisory committee or anything that works with the water recreation accounts? I noticed that this is only with, because we're kind of running into some problems with this about people who think that you shouldn't really spend the water recreation accounts on things that only benefit kayakers and canoeists. And so, I guess it's not appropriate to this bill, but I think Representative Osment, I'd like to talk to you about, you know, things to help move that along.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Meyer. Currently at this time, there is no oversight of our water recreation account.
Okay.
No oversight committee.
Okay.
Sorry. It was a long night last night.
Yeah. Okay. Further questions from members? Is there anybody from the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Osment.
Madam Chair, I don't know if the committee is... has a policy or not with regard to sunset dates, but it seems to me that because of the nature of this particular oversight committee, if it came back once every 10 years rather than once every 5 years,
yeah.
It may actually, because it does take time to get all these things, you know, have them drafted up and brought back before, and I don't know if there's how the committee feels about those. But.
Representative Osment, the way it is in the bill is 2010, which is 5 years longer than the 2005 originally on there. I guess, you know, if somebody wants to make an amendment, we'll talk about it.
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Kahn.
You know, I think we could have not have it come back at all, but, you know, 5 years doesn't seem, Representative Osment, as if carrying this bill was a really terrific burden on you. And possibly bringing it to our attention every 5 years is okay.
Thank you. Any further questions? Anything further, Representative Osment?
We'll vote.
Okay, Chair renews the motion that House File 1081, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee of Agriculture and Environment Finance. In discussion, all in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and bill is passed to Environment Finance. Thank you, Representative Osment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Okay, next up we have Representative Powell's bill, House File 1055. And... Chair will move that House File 1055 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Local Government. I believe that's correct, Representative Powell, Local Government?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And I don't see any amendments here. And I know that this bill is a little bit involved. So your bill is before us. Representative Powell, welcome to the committee. And please present your bill.
Madam Chair, just so I heard your motion right, it's 1555.
Yeah, if I said something different, I apologize. 1555. Representative Powell.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. In May of 2002, and within 8 months of the 9/11 terrorist attacks and anthrax scares, the Minnesota legislature extensively amended Minnesota statutes in an attempt to develop a coordinated response plan in an event of a terrorist attack here in this state. These powers are scheduled to expire in August of 2005. The Minnesota Department of Health is now proposing limited changes to the overall state response system for emergencies. These changes are based on a 2003 report mandated by the 2002 legislation and practical experience learned through drills and exercises and after consultation with the Department of Public Safety. These changes would better protect public health and safety in any type of emergency and reflect an all-hazard approach to planning and response. This model is being used in recognition of the fact that many kinds of emergencies have public health components in common. The all-hazard model provides a coordinated systemic approach to meeting the needs of people affected by an event, including the ill and injured. All responders, including police and healthcare providers, as well as the public, will be able to focus their efforts through a single unified system. Better integration of available resources will allow for a faster, more coordinated response to an event. The threshold for the declaration of peacetime emergency is found in current law in Chapter 12.31, Subdivision 2, and this reads in part that a peacetime declaration of emergency may be declared only when an act endangers life and property and local government resources are inadequate to handle the situation. Consequently, an act that would trigger a declaration in Cottonwood or Renville counties may not trigger a declaration in Hennepin or Ramsey County. Specifically, this bill adds a new liability protection in worst-case situations for all responders carrying out emergency plans in good faith. It clarifies that volunteers registered and acting under the direction of state or local government would have the same liability and workers' compensation protections as paid public employees during a disaster or an emergency. This bill sunsets public health emergency language from Chapter 12, allowing the governor and emergency managers to address emergencies of all types with the same broad array of authority. It enables professional licensees from Canada and Washington, D.C. to assist in meeting the needs of a declared emergency, just as Chapter 12 now recognizes licensees from all other states. It maintains provisions of identification and care of the deceased in an emergency. It also maintains the provisions on rights to refuse examination or treatment in an emergency. And I want to direct the members to something you found in your packet. I want you to take a look at the bill, 1555, and also a piece that's titled Minnesota Emergency Health Powers Act Provisions. You have that in your packet. The bill and the explanation of the changes that the department has provided look quite different. And when this was supplied to me, I went up to the revisor's office, and after some confusion, they decided that it was drafted correctly. And it's because of the sunset changes that appear on page 8 on line 15. This is a more transparent, what the department has provided is a more transparent observation of what we're doing in this bill. It just, and this is, I have not seen this before, but it just seems like for members to make good decisions and be fully informed, I thought I would insist and make sure that the department's explanation is provided. So with that, I have with me Assistant Commissioner Aggie Lighthizer from the Department of Health to answer any questions, or she may have some testimony she may want to give as well.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Aggie Lighthizer. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health. And I would just add, I think, a couple of things to what Representative Powell has already said, that it, and actually that Mr. Shepherd had in his analysis, that this is a very technically complicated issue with the sunset. And those of you who were here in 2002 and in 2004 may remember that there are isolation and quarantine provisions in the larger bill. Those pieces have been pulled out and are traveling in a separate bill, 1507. So this bill does not make the isolation and quarantine provisions permanent. That happens, and that discussion is in a separate bill.
Questions from members? Representative Dempsey.
Chairman, thank you, Ms. Chairman. Ms. Lighthizer, is that the name? I'm sorry.
Lighthizer, you're very
Lighthizer? Okay. I noticed on page 6, line 23, you have the definition for the purpose of this section. Subsection 1 definition for the purpose of this said emergency plan includes any plan. Why such a broad kind of an approach to any plan? I mean, aren't there some plans that already exist or that can be followed or implemented or whatever else the case may be? Or the things just are things merely created after something takes place? Or could you explain that to me, please?
Ms. Lighthizer. Madam Chair and Representative Dempsey. This provision or this section is about the situation where the healthcare system is overwhelmed and we're needing to establish sort of off-site or supplementary kinds of care. And this, the definition really, I think you need to read the whole sentence. It's any plan for managing an emergency threatening public health developed by the Commissioner of Health or a local public health agency. So it's really around the health management of people during a time when the usual health care system is not able to respond as it usually does. So it's the plans that are currently in place, or depending on the situation, may need to be doing supplemental planning for an event. And there are many plans that are already out there, and this is trying to encompass the public health and the healthcare side of planning.
Okay, and I understand that. Would, instead of any, would A reduce it in any way, shape, or form, or be negative? I mean, you can design some plans that can be, let's say you have a plan that says, well, because of the situation that exists, the emergency plan is we're going to take control of 15 homes. Well, that's part of the plan. Is that okay? I mean, I just don't understand quite how that, I need some reassurance with that, I guess. Could you help me with that?
Ms. Lighthizer.
Madam Chair and Representative, I think what we were trying to, I think that language would be acceptable, and I was just talking with the author, and he may speak on that as well. We were trying to clarify that it was the plans that were developed by either the Commissioner of Health or the local public health agency or by healthcare facilities, and we're trying to be encompassing of the plans that they were developing, but I think a plan would probably be, would work as well.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hall.
Representative Dempsey, if you want to make that, we'll incorporate that if you'd like.
Okay. But, Madam Chair.
Representative Dempsey, I'm sorry, I wasn't following that. Where are we? Are you, this is an oral amendment?
Yes.
Okay. If you could identify the page and line, please.
Well, I'm on page 6. And on lines 23 and 24, it talks about emergency plan. And it says any plan. I mean, I think a plan might be a little bit better, but still it wouldn't prevent us from maybe taking, as I said, property from some people that the state is taking property from private owners.
So,
I don't want that to happen. So,
page 6, line 25, are you striking the word Annie, A-N-Y, and inserting A?
Yes.
Just the letter A, so it would say A plan for managing. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, to the Dempsey or amendment. Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Seems to me that there's probably some contingency plans out there that are ready to go, but, you know, real life never follows the contingency plan exactly, and as events occur, someone on the scene has to make an emergency plan. You know, military, we call them frag orders. You know, orders on the fly to direct people where they got to go. I think that's what this means, and I think the word any allows someone to make some creative emergency plan on the fly. I don't think you need the word A. I think any is better myself.
Vote accordingly. Any other questions to the Dempsey or amendment?
Yeah.
Representative Lely.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you know, I guess I don't want to be too picky about this, but since we're talking about doing a little wordsmithing on this paragraph, you know, the way this is actually written, it sounds like it's the emergency that's being developed by the commissioner and not the plan. And so maybe what we need to do, if we're going to have, maybe Representative Dempsey would incorporate this, but should really read any plan developed by the commissioner, et cetera, for managing an emergency rather than the way it is. And maybe that actually would help to clarify this a bit, because I understand Representative Dempsey's problem here. When you begin to read this, it sounds very broad.
Okay, I'm just trying to figure out where we're at here. So I guess if Representative Dempsey would like to incorporate that oral amendment within his, we could talk about that. Otherwise, we do have one amendment in front of us. We would need to vote and then move to the second one. Representative Dempsey.
Well, Madam Chair, just to move the bill, I would ask the removal of my amendment.
Okay, Representative Dempsey withdraws his oral amendment on page 6, line 25.
Madam Chair,
do you want to follow up, Representative Dempsey?
Yes, Madam Chair. Then the other bit of information, and I just didn't get this in regard to the bill itself. But Hennepin and Ramsey counties were referred to, and could you explain to me again? I didn't get what is the significance of two counties being referred to in the bill. Could you help me with that?
Representative Paul.
Madam Chair, Representative Dempsey, I was merely giving an example.
Okay.
It was when I was talking about what a peacetime emergency may be and a declared emergency. And what we're doing is we're making it flexible. If something happened, for instance, a flood in Cottonwood County may overwhelm the ability for local governments mm-hmm. to respond.
Okay.
However, another emergency that happened perhaps in Ramsey County would not need to have a declaration because they do have the facilities and resources to respond to those types of emergencies. That was what my reference was about.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, we have several on the list. I believe next up was Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, I can't even remember what my comment was now. So.
Okay. I know Wardlow has been raised his hand here several times. Maybe not.
No, I
appreciate that.
Representative Wardlow.
I was just going to comment on that second amendment, but a lot of times the commissioner is not there almost all the time, so I don't want to restrict a plan to the commissioner when some ambulance driver is there directing the affairs. That's all I was going to say. You got to be flexible and ready to move anywhere you need, and if someone on the ground is doing the right thing, then he should be able to tell people, hey, you do this, you do this, you do this, and I'll smack you if you don't, you know.
Madam Chair, to that point.
Representative Paul.
Yeah, thank you. And I appreciate those comments, Representative Wardlow. I will tell you, though, that there's been a lot of planning since 9/11. And managers, first responders, police, fire, EMS have worked out through a lot of drills and training on this. And it really has been a bottom-up process. And I think that's what you're seeing here in this bill. You're seeing that we're making changes in current law because what we have learned in a short period of a couple of years. And most of those are bottom-up changes. So I think this does give the folks on the ground the ability to act in a flexible manner.
Okay, let's see here. We need to round back. Actually, I'd like to bring... Mr. Shepard, if you could just make note, too, of what's on our handout here, things we're supposed to be looking at the bill. I don't want to get too much offside of that. Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair and members, I had noted in my memo that I thought probably the main significance of this bill was what Representative Powell and Ms. Lighthizer pointed out, which is the sort of striking of the notion of a public health emergency generally, and so the powers would be used under the notion that existed before 2002 of a peacetime emergency.
Thank you. Okay, we still have lots of members with questions. Next up, Representative Liebling. Okay. Were you guys talking about the amendment earlier? Maybe it was on that list. Representative Loeffler.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, and perhaps this is to Ms. Lighthizer. I think this is a great bill, and it's a difficult issue to deal with, but I must admit I'm a little confused about the trigger point here. When we take out the language for defining a public health emergency, I know in my previous life there was a lot of discussion about how, you know, when you have a 9/11, you know what you have, or you have a flood, you know what you have. Oftentimes when you look at perhaps a public health emergency like SARS, which just came in on an airplane into Toronto, you don't always, right in those first couple of days, necessarily know what you're dealing with. You're just all of a sudden seeing people with some different, you know, health experiences that don't seem quite right, and you kind of trigger some alerts. And does this new language allow us sufficient authority in your mind to deal with that, those first few hours, days, while the medical community is trying to figure out, is this just an unusual flu, an incidence of something fairly normal, or we have something that potentially could be extremely infectious, and we need to activate this system. And so is there authority to act before there's that declaration of the type of emergency? Does it have to raise up to a sort of an outrageous level of problems before we can activate this?
Ms. Lighthizer.
Madam Chair, Representative Laufer, the triggering of the emergency declaration is to mobilize resources and to be able to respond. And I think the definitions and the approaches under a peacetime emergency would allow us to respond to a public health event. If we have a few individuals that have arrived in Minnesota with an infectious disease, that is handled more under the isolation and quarantine provisions and our ability to manage it through that bill. This is more about how do we take care of people, how do we get resources, how do we move supplies around, things like that, as we begin to see that the impact and our ability to respond is affected. That's what Chapter 12 provides for.
Okay, so those public
health... General Walker.
Just to follow up, so those public health issues are really kind of addressed in the other bill that we don't have in front of us. Thank you.
That's correct. That's why I have you. Yep. Okay, Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will pass.
Representative Beard, I understand you remember your question.
I did. Thank you.
Representative Beard.
It has to do with the sunset, Representative Powell. And just by the way, as I'm sitting here thinking about it, just by way of illustration about plans and how they're put into effect, even before September 11th, these plans existed to handle unusual emergencies in different parts of the state. If you remember the United Airlines DC-10 that crashed in Sioux City, Iowa here about 10 years ago. My wife works at St. Francis Hospital, and while that plane was in the air wandering around, there were all kinds of interesting imaginations going on all over southern Minnesota because no one knew for sure where that plane was coming down. And she came home with quite the stories to tell that night. As a healthcare professional, about how many times they'd been called and jerked around and buses that were put at the ready and things like that. So I'm grateful that there are people we pay to think about these things, make these plans, and every time an incident like that happens, we get to think about, okay, what worked, what didn't, how can we make it better? Which leads to my question about the sunset. We're removing some sunsets, actually allowing some sections to sunset in this bill, and we're removing sunsets on other sections. Now, generally speaking, my philosophy is that if it's a good idea today, it may not be a good idea in 5 or 6 years. We may want to revisit the issue. In the last bill, we talked about sunsets and how we put them on a DNR provision. Representative Powell, to this point, should we have sunsets in here? Are they retained somewhere and I'm not seeing it? Or are we confident enough that we've arrived with this version of the bill that we're just going to make it law and not come back again?
Representative Powell.
Madam Chair, Representative Beer. I think that the sunset provisions that were put in the law in 2002 was there because at the time this was quite controversial.
Okay.
And I went through all the video archives of this thing when it went through in 2002. The original bill had over 100 amendments attached as it went through the committee process. It was legislated to a fare thee well. But still, at the end of the day, in order to get it passed, and being the fact, if you go back, we were within 8 months of the terrorist attack. The legislature consented to this law, which was controversial, but had been legislated, and they put the sunsets on to see, and that gave many members some comfort. It passed with a wide bipartisan support in both chambers, but again, not without that controversy. Now we have the benefit of hindsight, experience with training, and the department, I think, has come up with some reasonable changes. Allow some to sunset, make some changes that now, again, in hindsight, look to be better options. I still think that there's going to be a little bit of controversy about some of the provisions that we don't allow to sunset. But those don't appear in my bill. That we're on a kind of a two-track. My bill is basically dealing with Chapter 12. Representative Abler's bill is dealing with Chapter 144.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Next up is Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In light of future considerations, I hope I'll yield my time to Representative Kahn.
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, I don't understand the language, the Section 21, the sunset. Does it, when you say those sections expire, doesn't it refer to the sections in this bill? And it looks like they expire the date. Oh, Mark is shaking his head so he can
Mr. Shepard.
What's that? Explain the sunset.
Madam Chair and members, and I will give Representative Kahn another document that explains this too, but this is sort of technically complex. What the sunset refers to is sunset of all of the new language and all of the amendments that were adopted in 2002. The sunset doesn't refer to the changes being made in this bill.
Okay.
And so what Representative Powell's bill is doing is allowing some of that 2002 law to go away, as he explained, and continuing the rest of it. And the handout that he had distributed sort of shows what's going away and what's staying from the 2002 law.
Yeah.
And so that may be helpful for you to see what, and I also brought copies of the 2002 law if you want to see sort of follow through from that. I'll give one to Representative Kahn so she can
Representative Kahn.
I did see that yesterday, but I just don't understand how you read this bill. Because when you get to the Section 21 sunset, when I read it, how do you know, why doesn't that provision not apply to the sections of the bill the way it's written in the bill?
Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair, if you look, and members of the committee, if you look on page 8, line 11 of the bill, that lead-in, it's what it's referring to is Laws 2002. Chapter 402. It's a 2002 session law that you're amending, and this sunset language appeared in the 2002 law.
Oh, I see. Right. So it's section 13. That section. Okay, I understand now. Thanks.
Representative O'Conn, are you all cleared up there?
Yep.
Good. Thank you, ma'am. That's the last name appearing on my list. I'm not looking very hard, except for maybe questions from the audience now. And I believe there is another testifier that would like to speak to the bill. Ms. Braze, if you'd approach and please identify yourself for the tape-recorded record of the meeting. Welcome to the committee. Happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Twyla Bray, Citizens Council on Healthcare, and you are dressed appropriately. This was a controversial bill in 2002, and we were one of the groups. We, along with some others, that particularly oppose the section having to do with quarantine and isolation. But before I get to that, I want to just go through the bill. And Representative Powell and I have talked, and he knows these concerns. So if we can just go to the first page, section 2, then I'll share these concerns with you. Section 2, lines 20. Well, page 1, lines 24 and 25, it adds the state's ability to take over and control healthcare facilities. Healthcare facilities are filled with people who are sick, who are dying, who are there because they are themselves ill. And our concern here is that we could have the Department of Health deciding who lives, who dies, who gets what kind of medication, who gets which treatment, and they could actually ration health care. And because they take over the facility, there are nurses and there are doctors, but by taking over the facility, it's entirely possible that they could control the decisions that are made. And we think that that should not be the case, that physicians, at least, that, I mean, there are decisions that would have to be made, but not that they would come from the state level. So we would like to have that language removed from there. Then if you go to page 7, line 1. Oh, actually, you can go page 6, the very last line. Talking about emergency plans, and they should include provisions for protecting children, people with disabilities, and persons with limited English proficiency. Our concern, particularly with the language adding their control of the healthcare facility, is that the elderly are not included in here. And so that they would not actually have to take into consideration all the elderly that are sitting in a healthcare facility or in a hospital, and could actually perhaps use that as a way to ration care to the elderly in particular. So if that language were added, elderly persons, we would appreciate that. And then then we go to the sunset. And our great concern with the sunset is not only that they're getting rid of Section 11, which you can see in what the health department put out. How does one designate that here? On page 4, 11, having to do with termination by the legislature, our concern is that there is no legislative control or power of the representatives of the people to make a decision to discontinue an emergency, particularly if they see that it's going in a direction that harms their constituents. So this is an opportunity for legislators to get together and vote. And indeed, we could take out for a public health emergency like the rest of the language, but we still think it's a good idea for the legislature to have some ability to control what's even happening in their districts by calling the legislature together if they see a need. Now, here's we come now to the controversial part of the bill in 2002, and that's the sections you cannot see. They are not before you. But they are sections 18 and 19, which are not being sunsetted, and that means they're being made permanent policy. And Mark Shepard did a very good job of saying that on the bottom of his description of this bill. He says the bill would also make permanent the powers of the Commissioner of Health related to isolation and quarantine. And indeed, that is true. And what you need to understand about that, and I brought something here in order to try and give you a visual. Here we go. Chapter 12, Emergency Powers. Chapter 144, Ongoing Health Care Department or Health Department Powers. 144 and Section 18 and 19, which are being made permanent policy, allow the health department to quarantine anyone at any time without a declared emergency, without a court order, for 48 hours. So at this day, on this very day today, when it's a blue sky outside and the governor is who knows where, someone from the health department could go to someone and put them in quarantine. No judge would have to be contacted, no court order, because it's in Chapter 144. It's not like the rest of everything that's in the bill, which is in Chapter 12, which is emergency management. This is ongoing authority. And despite what Ms. Lightfager says, I was happy to see that, no, what you have to understand is it's not just in the other bill. It is actually in this bill. Mark Shepard put that in his rundown for the bill for you. And you need to understand, if Representative Abler's bill went away, didn't pass, these powers would become permanent because of Representative Powell's bill. And he and I have discussed that. That is a great concern of ours, and we would like to have 18 and 19 sunset. And if they don't sunset, they should for sure have a court order. Right now, there's no court order, no judicial review, nothing for this temporary hold provision that's in chapter or in Section 19. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. I'm waiting for questions from our panel, but Representative Powell, do you have any comments or rebuttal to that
issue? Well, Mr. Chairman, a couple things. Ms. Brace is correct, I think, and her analysis of if Representative Abler's bill did not pass, and my bill did as it sits right now, yep, 18 and 19 would become permanent law then. It's arguable whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. People do differ on that, and that was a bone of contention in 2002. On the termination of declaration, that was also a bone of contention. The way that it's set up now, and I think perhaps the department's going to want to talk about this as well, but the way that the law is set up now, we have public health emergencies. If we take that away and go to the all-hazard approach, then what we would have, we certainly wouldn't want to have an automatic calling of the legislature back into session just because it flooded in Roseau or we had a tornado in St. Peter. I think what Ms. Brace is saying is that if things were to get out of control, then there may not be, she would contend that there would not be any ways for the legislature to control a rogue governor, for instance. You know, it's a fair point, I suppose. I think there's probably some middle ground that could be found on the termination of on this and making sure that the legislature does have a role to play. But I think because she makes a fair point.
Your next stop for this bill, I believe, is local gov.
Yes, sir.
Because I have some concerns also about the lack of a sunset provision on some of these things that we're just allowing to become law. We've proceeded for 2 years now, apparently, with no great mischief, but the sunset has been a comfort to some of us. I wonder if it would hurt to do that again and have the bill amended in, as it comes to local gov, or do it here. I guess that's the committee's choice. But
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, and Mr. Representative Powell.
I would just urge that we allow the department to comment on that. I will comment again that it has been the department's strategy, wish, desire to keep, to have my bill kind of concentrate on Chapter 12 of the law.
Mm-hmm.
And the all hazards approach for emergency declarations, and the quarantine piece be carried in the other bill that Representative Aver is carrying, which is concerned with Chapter 144.
Thank you, Ms. Brady. Before I go to some questions from the members here,
Mr. Chair, my request is that if 18 and 19 are allowed to become permanent policy and stay as they are listed in this bill as not being sunsetted, then this bill should go to civil law because it is a civil law issue.
Thank you. Your request is heard. Representative O'Conn.
Not quite. I want to know if legislators are exempt from quarantine.
Well, that's a fair question. Mr. Shepard, can you speak to that?
Stupidity of the brain.
We'd have to do further research on that, Representative O'Conn.
Okay. I just want to know if, you know, like, brain stupidity or something is a point.
Yeah. Well, if that is possible, I'd like to be on that panel that makes that choice. That would be a good one. Representative O'Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. just following our learned counsel. Representative Kahn, do you know anything I don't know? Is there something I should be worried about?
I just thought something like, you know, excess stupidity is catching.
Huh?
Okay, members, allow me to rein this back in and stay to a serious topic today. Thank you for the effort. Representative Demmer, is it to this point, or should we have the department test? Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, my question relates back to a comment that Representative Paul made about a quote-unquote rogue governor, whatever. Is there a means now that the legislature can convene in special session without the governor calling us?
Representative Powell or Mr. Shepard?
Mr. Chairman, you're asking the wrong fellow.
Okay, let's... Okay, we'll give Mr. Shepard a moment to research that, and we'll ask the department to comment on some of the... let's see, this is... looking for your name up here.
Aggie Lighthizer.
Ms. Lighthizer, please, you had some response to some of the questions and comments that were just raised.
Yes.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to first clarify that I misspoke when I said earlier about the isolation and quarantine provisions, which are Section 18 and 19, not expiring. We went back and forth a number of times with the revisor's office to try to manage the sunset language in a way that was understandable, and I was working off of old information, so I apologize for being incorrect on that. I think the issue about health facilities, the language that was added last year by the House that we continued this year is that a licensed health care facility would be used only when other alternatives are not feasible. One of the challenges we have in thinking about the health care system being overwhelmed is what's a reasonable place to put people, and we've been working throughout the state and looking at resources and facilities that could accommodate a large number of people. And under the provision that's here is that the licensed healthcare facility would be only if nothing else is available. I think another question about the plans, making sure that we're protecting children, persons with disabilities, and persons with limited English proficiency, and adding elderly to that. I don't see any opposition from our perspective to that. I want to clarify, though, that this provision is about providing liability to the responders in a region, and its intent is to provide sort of a framework for that, and that's the intent of Section 11. And I think the other issues were about isolation and quarantine, which are in another bill. And I do believe this bill would be moving to civil law as part of its path.
Yes, I think local government, I think, is its
next
stop
until here. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Howell.
That's correct. Apparently we are going to go to civil law. That has been added since I...
That's another stop beyond local government, Representative?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Maybe as just a favor to this committee, if you would have an author's amendment at your next stop to add that, protect the elderly on page, was it 7, or where their concern was? Top of page 7.
Mr. Chairman, the department and I agree we will do that.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Other questions or comments from the committee? We're going to turn to Mr. Shepard to see if the legislators are in danger of some sort of quarantine. Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, the question was whether there's any provision that allows the legislature to come back into special session.
Oh, that was the question. Okay.
By itself. And there is a Minnesota Statutes 3.95 provides that if there's an enemy attack on the United States and the governor doesn't call a special session, then the legislature is supposed to convene 30 days after the inception of the attack. And I do question whether this would be constitutional, given the constitutional requirement that only the governor can call the legislature back into special session. But it is on the books, and it has been for about 45 years. It was enacted back in the Cold War era.
1961.
Keep an eye on Iowa.
Well, thank you. That's a little off topic. Let's come back to on topic here, but thank you for the for clarifying that.
Mr. Chair?
Ma'am?
In addition to that language, also in Chapter 12, when the President declares a national security emergency because of an enemy attack, the governor is required to call the legislature into session in order to declare a state of emergency in Minnesota.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, well, the reason that particular question was maybe off topic, but I think it was important to understand in relation to Mr. Grace's comment and a concern that I would have also about a rogue governor, if you will, and that's no disperse whatsoever. I have big confidence in Governor Plenty and have no concerns about that whatsoever. Make that clear. Mm-hmm. But I was just wondering if there was any mechanism, and this would not cause a problem. In other words, this bill would not cause the legislature to not be able to intervene, because we can't anyway. That was the point I was going to make. I was also reading on page 2, lines 30, 31, 32, 33, in this issue of, a rogue governor, if you will, being able to impose things upon the public without the legislature having any input. It says, if the legislature is in session, or if the governor calls... calls us back, then he may exercise the power of duty conferred and imposed. Now, that would imply to me that if we're not in session, or if he doesn't call us in session, that he can't do that. So I wonder if that doesn't deal with what that issue was. That's my question, I guess. And I don't know if that's a question or a comment or whatever, but dealing with the issue of, not having legislation, not being able to have any say.
We'll take that as a comment on the bill, absent any other discussion or comment to that point.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like a response, I guess, from Mr. Shepard about whether that would in fact be the case.
Mr. Shepard, do you need a moment for that? Or,
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I believe that what Representative Demmer said is accurate, and I'd like to perhaps double-check with Ms. Lighthizer, who's worked with this statute, too, on page 2 lines. The language on lines 30 to 36, just providing that if the legislature's in session, or if it's not, if the governor calls the session, that then the governor can exercise the special powers for 30 days.
Ms. Lighthizen.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. This section refers to, again, the national security emergency, if there's enemy sabotage or other hostile action.
So if I understand it right, this subdivision 1 on the bottom of page 2 described with a declared national emergency, which would come from Washington, I believe. This does not apply to a local emergency in the Red River Valley, the potential like we had with the United Airlines incident or something like tornado. This does not apply to that.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
This is only a national emergency. Members, does that clarify this issue or does that raise more questions? As it does in my mind. Representative Hoppe.
Mr. Chair, I am fully informed and ready to vote.
Thank you. Further discussion or questions? Anyone else in the audience for or against this bill? Who made this motion? Well, then the chair will renew the motion that House File 1552 be passed from this committee and referred to the 1555. Representative Powell, I think we've had difficulty with that number today. That we pass from this committee and refer it to local government. Further discussion? Seeing none, let's vote. All in favor signify by aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The bill is passed to the Committee on Local Government. Thank you, Mr. Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee.
The next bill up on our agenda today is House File 1432. That will be Representative McNamara. 1438, for crying out loud. It's St. Patrick's Day. My eyes are crossed, I'm afraid.
Mr. Chair, I think it's the shirt.
It's the shirt. That must be it. Thank you, Representative Weisenheimer. This would be Representative McNamara, who wants us all desperately to believe he's Irish, but he's actually Scottish, and I know it. Representative McNamara, welcome to the committee. And if you would like to move your bill to civil law, I believe, right?
Thank you, Mr. O'Chair. Actually, I would prefer this bill be put on the general register. I'd like to move House File 1438 be adopted and moved to the general register.
Okay, time out here while the chair has a little
unless you've gotten an email back in the last couple of
minutes. I have
some
other information here. Let's just have a little note.
Thank you.
The gentleman can always change it on the floor. Mr. Representative McNamara, we will entertain your motion that 1438 be passed and sent to the general register. If civil law has a request, we'll deal with that on the floor of the House, okay? So that is the motion in front of us. Representative McNamara, proceed. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll give a very brief overview of the bill, and then Mr. Bob Tomlinson from Division of Forestry, Assistant Director, can do a better job. This bill would authorize the DNR to more efficiently record state forest road maps that it currently has throughout Minnesota. It also spells out the way we'll notify the affected property owners via the local paper and a direct mailing to them in how that would proceed. Mr. Chair, I do have, I believe you've been passed out the old AO5-0300 amendment.
Oh.
I guess if we could, it would be nice if I could move that to get it in the shape of the form. And I probably should explain the amendment a little bit.
Representative McNamara, give us the number of that amendment again. There seems to be some confusion here about
AO5-0300.
Give us a moment while staff is looking for that. I didn't see it in my packet. Any other members have it? Anybody have one here?
Sorry for that confusion, Mr. Chair. I think the time would be well spent to review the bill, and we'll add the amendment after you've had a chance to see it. The amendment basically, the counties have approached us. The page has gotten it. It's gone to make copies.
It's in good hands. Thank you. Go ahead and proceed with the bill.
So maybe we'll just skip the amendment totally for now until you have it in your hand.
Thank you.
I'll let Assistant Director Tomlinson proceed to explain the bill.
Thank you. Mr. Tomlinson, welcome to the committee, and if you'd identify yourself for the recorded record, I'd appreciate it.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Tomlinson. I am the Assistant Director for the DNR's Division of Forestry. Before we go into the bill, if you will, I'd like to try and help put this into context a bit. We handed out a map that I think you should have before you. And, excuse me, the front side of the map that shows the little red squiggles on the map, basically we did that. We realize it's not very specific, but it just kind of shows you the distribution, if you will, of the 2,200 miles or so of State Forest Road system around the state. And it affects, basically, it's throughout about 28 counties or thereabouts in those areas that you can see laid out there. And so you get a better understanding of where we're talking about with the State Forest Road system. The State Forest Road system, 2,200 miles long. We get a little bit of gas tax money that we put into that each year, about $350,000 or so. And plus we put some general fund money towards helping to maintain that. And in years past, we've also spent bonding money, capital investment money on that, on longer-term culvert replacements and those sorts of things, just to give you an understanding. I didn't come prepared to go into a lot of detail on the funding and how we spend it, but the point I want to make is that we have a lot of, over the years, generated a lot, spent a lot of taxpayers' dollars, if you will, on maintaining and keeping up the State Forest Road system. It's probably, most of the roads within the system are 50 years old or older. They've been around and for quite some time. If you turn over the page on the map, you'll notice that there's a very specific area that here. This was one that Representative McNamara is actually quite familiar with. And did you want to explain this, or do you want me to? The point I want to make is that you can see the Mud Creek Road there that it points to is a county road that Representative McNamara travels on when he's going up to his deer hunting cabin. And the red and black road that goes off of that is a state forest road. This is part of that 2,200 miles that we've inventoried as part of the state forest road system. Obviously, this is only about a mile and a half or 2 miles long. Mm-hmm. But what it does, the important thing here is to show that it goes across county tax forfeited land first here for about a mile or so. It goes northwesterly there. It kind of loops through a 120-acre piece of private land. Then it goes and it spurs off to the south, and you can see it accesses a large block of state-owned land. And the other spur goes further west and goes into mining company land, USX Corporation land. And it ends up where I'm assuming that the landowner there with the 80 acres directly to the west of the end of it probably uses that road to get access back into his 80-acre parcel as well. So many of the state forest roads like this one go across multiple ownerships. And the road, this road in particular, accesses four or five parcels. And the road shown is primarily used by, want to emphasize here, for recreational purposes. There's deer hunters, grouse hunters, bird watchers, berry pickers, fisher persons, or the lake there that people might have a trail going back into the lake there, etc. It's used to a lesser degree by the logging industry in northern Minnesota and throughout the state's forest, and it's also used for forest management purposes for the foresters to get in and out. So it's in our interest to try and maintain that road up to the standards that we can for the public to use it, and it is also in our interest to maintain that access that we've generated over several decades, if you will, throughout this 2,200-mile road system. The bill before you today basically is one that would direct us to follow a certain process to more officially record what we refer to as what apparently the legal folks refer to as prescriptive easements, where these roads have been traditionally going across these private lands. Apparently, we have a prescriptive easement. I'm not a lawyer, my understanding is we would already have a prescriptive easement across that parcel that was shown to you in the example. What we want to do is take in an efficient, transparent process to go through and officially record these on a county-by-county or smaller basis throughout the state that we get these in. And the reason that this is important, more important to do this now, is because of the fact of a lot of the industrial ownership in the state is uncertain. forest products industries. In the past, they own about 1 million acres in northern Minnesota, which is interspersed with the state land and the federal land and the other lands. And we want to assure that as the those ownerships potentially change owners, that we also have a right to continue to use those roads in the future. So that, in essence, is why we're doing it. I guess going through the bill, I would just point out quickly, I think I can do this fairly fast, that subdivision one of the bill just basically provides the authorization for the commissioner to adopt this process. Subdivision two lays out the map requirements for the bill and for the county to work with, for the state to work with, I'm sorry, on a county level. Subdivision three lays out the procedure for us to adopt the map, shows that we must prepare an official map for each county or smaller geographic area. If we get into this, for example, in Pine County, I think there's at least two, maybe three state forests. It might make sense for us to do it on the three state forests, individual of one another, and follow that type of a process. It also sets at a time and a place and a date for us to do a public hearing. We would have to follow that. Further down on line 16, you'll notice there's a 15, 16, 17 there. It makes note that at least 30 days before the hearing, the notice, hearing notice must be sent by mail to the property owners most directly affected. These would be the ones where that land, where the road, current road, already crosses their ownership. And further down that, it also points out in lines 23 on down that the recorded state forest road map must be dated and signed by the commissioner. It must be recorded with the county recorder within 90 days that the map is adopted. All of this process basically comes from the township, the language dealing with the, how the legislature directed the townships to follow. Similar process, I think back in the early 90s, I'm not sure of the dates, but it's in statute 164-35 is my understanding. Subdivision 4 lays out an appeal process. If somebody disagrees that we with us and says, or it says, you know, it really would serve my purposes better if this road wasn't located here because I don't like all the traffic that's using it and that sort of a thing, then we'll try and work something out with those persons on a case-by-case basis as we go through this and try and maybe change the access to the road and split the cost of doing so or that sort of an approach like that. We don't anticipate an awful lot of appeals, but it would certainly be prudent to expect that we will get some appeals and we'll have to try and work with those folks on a case-by-case basis as we go through it. Additionally, we want to make sure in subdivision 5 that this would only deal with the, it wouldn't pertain to unrecorded roads or trails not affected, i.e. Snowmobile trails or ATV trails and those sorts of things like that that are not affected by it. Only those parts that are part of the official state forest road system. And then subdivision 6 is the exemption from rulemaking process in going through this. We would anticipate taking probably 4 or 5 years we expect to try and go through this process. We're not looking for any extra funding or anything out of the legislature to accomplish it. We just think it's in the state's best interest to try and the cost interest to try and accomplish this. We feel that by doing so, the properly recorded state forest roads under the statutory authority given here will greatly increase the value of the private lands that utilize the access of those pieces. Recording the state forest roads will provide a solid basis for protecting a system of public access to public lands, and I mentioned that that is especially important now given the uncertainty of industrial land ownership holdings in the northern part of the state and other land ownership changes that occur. And we also feel that recording of our forest roads will provide a legal access for large industrial ownership, as I just said, that, for the potential of being subdivided into smaller parcels in the future. So in essence, that is the bill and the reason why we think it's a smart bill and one that will provide us the access that us being the public access to these very important pieces of state forest land in northern, well, in those counties as shown throughout the state of Minnesota.
Representative McNamara, I understand the 300 amendment has now been distributed. If you want to officially move that, and then we'll get that on the bill and talk about it further. Representative McNamara.
If I could, I would like to move the amendment AO5-0300, and then I could explain it.
Okay, it's been moved. Discussion, Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The counties have approached us, and they would like to have permissive language that would allow them to do the same to their county forest roads. And I guess that's the gist of it, Madam Chair, that they would like some permissive language to also be included. I guess just prior to hearing what the members have to say, I think our map in regards to the Mud Creek Road does a good job of showing how this will work. As Assistant Director Tomlinson has said, with the massive sales of some of these industrial corporate properties happening recently in northern Minnesota, potentially this USX property that we see here could change hands, and the interpretation of that road and how it affects those two individual private property owners at the end of that road just shows why we want to be sure that this is changing hands, that it's clear that the road is there and that it and it's what its use is for. So I guess we're open to discussion, Madam Chair.
Questions on the 300 amendment? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative McNamara. I don't see a necessarily a representative of the counties here, but I'm wondering, I mean, this seems like sort of a substantive change in terms of something that wasn't considered in the policy committee in terms of expanding this to a whole different subject here. I don't know how many county forest roads there are or aren't, but I think that if someone owns property abutting a county forest road, they wouldn't have thought originally they were impacted by this bill as it was introduced. And so maybe you can give us some context here.
I see somebody coming forward, and I understand, Representative McNamara, that if this amendment goes on, your motion to which committee this will go to will switch. So it may need to go to local government. Is that correct, Representative McNamara?
That would be correct, Madam Chair. And the Chair of Local Government has been kind enough, Representative Olson has left the room to check and see between he and, because we have heard from civil law, the original recommendation was to go to the floor. It'll either be going to civil law or local government, and I think we'll know the answer here within a few minutes.
We'll,
thank you, Madam
make
Chair.
That new motion at the end of the meeting here. We have somebody here to testify. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record. You want to pull the mic up?
My name is Bruce Cox. I'm the Clearwater County Land Commissioner, as well as the Chairman of the Minnesota Association of County Land Commissioners. There's 15 counties represented by that group. We are in favor of this bill, and we are also in favor of the amendment. We brought it to the DNR's attention that we would like to be involved in it. We face the same issues in our county forest road network that the state does. And I just to shed a little light on it, this is the same, essentially the same language that townships use in their alternative recording process. And I believe that legally it's a good process to go through, and by combining our efforts with the state, it will be very productive for us.
Representative Loeffler, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And to the witness, does the Association of Minnesota Counties have an official position? I understand you represent a subset of them, but has it been addressed by the larger group?
Mr. Cox?
Madam Chair, Representative, I've been working with the Association of Minnesota Counties on this. It's something that just came up, and in order to get something through as an official policy of AMC, we haven't had time, but we haven't had any resistance from anybody. And essentially, from our perspective, on the, as far as the amendment goes, those 15 counties are essentially the only players in this that will use this bill.
Okay, Representative McNamara, you'd have some time between now and the next committee to get some kind of formal information on that.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Loeffler, I would say as we get ready to go to local government, which if this amendment goes on, it will do, we'll look for the direction from the Association of Counties. And if they're not in favor of it, I would say we would ask to revert back to the original purpose of the bill if we don't feel them. It's permissive language for them. It's at their desire, and if for some reason they are fractured and aren't in unison in their direction, I would say that I would not be in favor of going there.
Okay. To the 300 amendment, next up is Representative Hoppe.
I will pass, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other questions on the 300 amendment? Okay, let's take a vote on there. Representative McNamara's motion to the A05-300 amendment. All in favor of that, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Okay, Representative McNamara, you have the bill with the amendment on it. Further questions? Representative Ruth Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the previous witness, now back in the chair again. In your yourself, sir.
Mr. Thomason.
Thank you. In your summary comments of your previous testimony, you made a passing reference to the preservation of public land and how that preservation will be supported by this particular legislation. Could you expand on that just a moment?
Mr. Thomason.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm sorry if I use the word preservation of public land. I'm not certain that that was my exact comment, but what I meant to say was what we're trying to do is preserve the access that we currently enjoy to those public lands, not necessarily preserve the lands themselves. I'm not too concerned about that. What I am concerned about is maintaining or preserving the access that we currently have throughout the state to get back into many parcels of state forest public lands and in the county forest public lands in order that would use these kind of a road system.
Thank you for that clarification, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Mr. Tomlinson, you had indicated that subdivision for the appeal process that you were expecting an opportunity to sort of informally work with people, but I don't see that reflected in the language. If I were a property owner, I hear from one of my constituents who happens to have bought one of these parcels along the road, if they saw this, they would assume they had to go out and get an attorney and pursue it through district court. And I guess I would be much more comfortable if there were something in the language that implied there were opportunities to meet and confer this. I can imagine my father had some property up in northern Minnesota. I don't know if it was near a forest land or not, but he really loved that property. And you know, he would have wanted to know which trees were his and which were someone else's, and the kind of map that we got here wouldn't answer those kind of questions. And I think that, you know, I mean, he worked out with, I know, on a township road, you know, fish agreements on, like, how they grade it to preserve certain things and whatever. And so I think you're going to potentially end up with a lot of property owners who are going to have a lot of issues and whose initial reaction will be pretty angry if they think they're just sent this map and the only alternative to deal with it is to go to court. And I would kind of like to see, particularly when we're exempting this from rulemaking, kind of make it explicit and have it in the notice that there is, you know, an informal process that can be worked out, particularly when the maps are being done by aerial photographs. And I've never seen what an aerial photograph that you can draw a map from is and how detailed it is. But I suspect there might be some things that aren't as clear from an aerial photograph as there might be from somebody who's, you know, aware of the property at the ground level.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, thanks for that comment. I think it's important to understand that what we want to do is look at the, trying to minimize the times that we're going to be in court. We don't want to be spending time going to court and fighting, if you will, over who owns what relative to roads and things. We also, I think, generally speaking, that we find that the best opportunities to try and work out things with landowners is to try and do it at the most local level possible, between the forester and, like, their area forest supervisor in this case, and whoever it might be that suggests that he'd like some change to it. We'll be very, the roads are in place now. There's, you know, there isn't anything, we're not talking about going in building new roads or anything. This is just for ones that are in place currently and have been in place for several years and more commonly a few decades or more. My sense is that they'd be notified, directly notified in the mail, and that they would then perhaps come to the public meeting with ideas on how they might like to see things work differently. And at that point, we would sit down and start working with those folks to see if we couldn't work things out differently.
Follow-up for Senator Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, my concern is actually the public hearing I don't think works effectively if much of this property is owned by people who live outside of the area. Since much of this is seasonal recreational-type property or hunting-type property that would be owned by people who don't live there. So I'm not sure. In many instances, a public hearing is a really effective way to have that personal person-to-person interaction, but I think it's not very feasible for many property owners, and so I would, you know, like to see something like the notice says you can attend the public hearing or you may call so-and-so, or, you know, have some alternative here that works for what I suspect is a significant portion of the property owners. I'm not trying to make your process unworkable. I'm trying to make it actually a good public relations effort on the behalf of the state as it tries to work with those property owners.
Representative McMahon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Loeffler, I think you bring up a good point, and one I'm thinking this as Assistant Director said, this happens to be in an area I'm somewhat familiar with, and looking at this map, I think there's a good chance that Lester Beatty may not live in northern St. Louis County. He may live somewhere else, and it might not be efficient for him. And I think that's a good idea that we would allow him to have some, maybe some written testimony or at least some verbal testimony, and maybe we should make that in here. I don't know if you want to try and do this on the fly, Madam Chair. We develop it prior to, after conferring with Representative Wilson, we're going to be going to local government. I think we should incorporate something about the opportunity for the affected property owners to react in writing and potentially get that conversations going, because many of these property owners will not be necessarily local there. Many will, but some will not.
So, Representative McMahon, you're going to work on an amendment that you put on in the next committee. Is that what you're talking about? Representative McMahon?
Yeah, and unless you have more questions, Madam Chair, possibly might be able to develop something here in the next few minutes, but otherwise I'd be glad to work with Representative Loeffler and DNR can address those, because those are concerns of mine now.
Representative McMahon, you know, I'd like to get out of the room here in about 7 minutes, because the next committee will be coming in.
Well, we're going to have two stops, Madam Chair, local gov and
civil law.
So we will work on it before it goes to local gov.
Okay, sounds great. Any further questions from members? Is there anybody from the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Okay, I think we're ready to make the appropriate motion for where the bill is going. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to renew, but to change my motion that this bill be sent to local government.
And that would be House File 1435 as amended. Everybody understand that?
1438, Madam Chair.
Excuse me. We're having trouble with the numbers today, Madam.
New class.
I think it's St. Patrick's Day. What's messing us up?
Representative McNamara moves that House File 1438, as amended, be recommended passage and referred to the Committee on Local Government. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and bills going to local government. Thank you, Representative McNamara. Members, I think we have a handout coming around. If you want to just wait until you get that real quick. Scott, is that coming around? Okay, it's a list of bills, and these are what we're looking for Monday, probably. Next week we're meeting Monday night, Tuesday night, and then on Tuesday and Wednesday we're meeting during our regular committee time. So we'll be covering these bills, and we have several other we'll probably add to the list. So you really need to check the website if you want to look for doing an amendments or doing some research before the meeting. But we will be doing at least these bills and probably more. And so with that, members, meeting is adjourned.